name's John Allred, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm glad to finally make it here. Who didn't turn their phone off? Okay. It has been a great weekend, and one thing I was thinking about, I want to thank Fred and Martha and the whole committee for putting this on and for inviting me to come up and share, because this doesn't just happen. It really doesn't. There's a ton of work that goes on into this, and I hope none of you take this for granted that this will just happen every weekend or every year, because it doesn't have to happen every year. It can go away. You know, when I moved to Dallas, I was a year and a half sober. I moved to Dallas in 83, and we had a little roundup in Dallas called Lone Star Roundup, and it's in August, and I moved there in February, but I had a little job for that first Lone Star Roundup I attended, and there were about 600 people there. I was a little usher, helping people find a seat, and the next year I was usher again, a welcome a greeter and usher. We had about 800 people there, and then about 5 years ago, Lone Star Roundup had grown. We had about 4,000 people at Lone Star Roundup. It's great. In August, third weekend of August, and I had been having a little job on that. Then I got where I couldn't be there a lot, so I didn't have a job the last few years. But about three or four years ago, it ended. It went from 4,000 to end. It's over. So these things don't just happen, you know. And if you want to ensure that this kind of weekend goes on, then get involved and be active and ask Fred what you can do to, you know, to be of service on the committees and do stuff, because these are great, and this is a weekend that, I mean, I miss Lone Star. And now they're trying to start some else up, but I just throw that out there because I want you to know that Fred and the committee and Martha and all those guys, they put a lot of work into this. It doesn't just happen. There's a lot of work and planning that goes on into it, and I hope you all appreciate it and keep it going, because this is a great week. This is my second time I've been here, and I just love it. I got a kick out of all the speakers. Sandy's one of my favorite. My wife loves Sandy, and was sorry she couldn't make it down to hear him, and she loves Clancy. What can I say? You know, she's a sick Allen on. She does. I said, you love Clancy? She said, I just love the way he calls you guys little pukes. You sick Allen on, you know. So. But she really wanted to be here and was sad she couldn't. We've got we have custody of our little granddaughter, and some stuff came up. She couldn't leave. But it's been wonderful, and I've enjoyed all the speakers, and I hope that next year, I don't know where we're going to have it, but I'm sure that Fred will put out a flyer on it and probably say go back to the Holiday Inn. I like what Clancy talked about last night. I thought I'd talk a little bit about that today, because our primary purpose, you know, and alcoholism and that disease of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I buy into that disease of alcoholism, that this is a disease that has symptoms, can be treated but not cured, if I buy into that whole disease deal of alcohol, then what my mind tells me, if this is a disease, my mind tells me, well, then A's got nothing to offer. I mean, right? Because if it's a disease, then I need professional medical treatment, not just talk. You know, it's got to be medically supervised. Have to have the number one success rate of recovery. Remember those advertisements? And I'm busy. I couldn't be there all the time. Couldn't go every night. So I'd have to have like maybe a 2 week or 30-day treatment program. I could go with a couple 2-day follow-ups on that thing. That's what my mind tells me until you start to understand the nature of the disease. And the book says if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, the only shot you got at recovery is a spiritual awakening. It means God's going to be involved. And when God gets involved, miracles happen. And there's no way to explain a miracle. Okay? And God works in miracles, and there's no way to explain what happens. The reason you can't explain something, that's what makes it a miracle. If you could explain it, it wouldn't be a miracle. You know? Would it? I mean, think what would happen if Moses tried to explain his miracles. Can't you see that? Moses, now he's got the children of Israel. He's got them out there. They're held captive in Egypt for 247 years. A lot of people didn't know that. I know that. They're held captive down there for 247 years. And then Moses, the great deliverer, comes along. He's going to take them out of Egypt back to the promised land. Y'all see that movie? I know you didn't read the book. Okay. So Moses got the children of Israel. They get out there. Now they get stopped at the Red Sea. They don't know how to cross the Red Sea. They're talking about it. They're holding a committee. Group conscious. Yeah, we're going to cross the Red Sea. And all of a sudden they come running up to Moses. They say, Moses, we've got a problem. Pharaoh changed his mind. He's coming to get us. What are we going to do? Moses, I don't know. Let me go talk to God, find out what God wants to do about this. So Moses goes talk to God. He comes back in. Calls his committee in there. He's got his committee. He's got his medical consultants. He's got his psychiatric consultants. He's got his engineering consultants. He's got his legal consultants. Kind of sounds like intervention, doesn't it? And of course, you got to have your PR consultant there, right? So he's got all his consultants in there, and he says, okay, this is incredible. I've talked to God. Here's the plan. Here's what's going to, I'm going to stand up on this rock. I'm going to take the staff of Aaron. I'm going to wave the staff over the Red Sea. I don't know how this is going to happen. It's going to be great. The Red Sea is just going to part. It's going to open up and part like that. I know it's underwater now, but when it parts, that ground's going to be dry. And then all of us are going to march. Now, there were 3,746,341. A lot of people didn't know that. All 3 million of us are going to march through the Red Sea, and then when we get through, the Pharaoh's going to come after and get us. Water's going to fall down and drown them all. What do you think of the plan? Can't you see those medical consultants? Oh, Moses. Bad plan, Moses. Rotten plan. We got a lot of old people with us here, Moses. Okay, I don't care if you part the Red Sea. It's going to be humid. It's going to be humid. These old people, they got asthma. Okay? You make them march through there. That asthma's going to be terrible, Moses. Don't even try it. Won't work, Moses. Psychiatric consultants, Moses. Terrible. Forget about the old people. How they're going to die. Okay? What about these youngsters? Think about all these youngsters. You've got all these little kids. You realize the psychological trauma. You stack that water. You force them to march through there. That's going to scar them emotionally. We'll have former adult children, Moses, to get through the rest of their life. Terrible plan, Moses. Legal guy says, Moses, forget about it. That's a foreign country. Other side of there, that's a foreign country. We got immigration problems. Can't do it, Moses. Rotten plan. Only guy on Moses' side? PR. Guy says, Moses, baby. Love that plan. Love the plan. You pull that off, I can promise you 5 pages in Genesis. See, how are you going to explain a miracle? You can't explain. That's why we can't explain AA. We try to explain how this deal works. Like I said last night, we don't know why it works. We try it. Even the old-timers don't know how this thing works. You see that? Those old-timers are so funny, man. Their timing's terrible. They're off a little bit. The timing's a little slow. You mean the newcomers meeting? You ever been there? Newcomers meeting. Some newcomer sharing. He's crying. He says, a week ago tonight, I'm in a hot tub. 5 naked women. All the booze I can drink. Some old-timer chimes in and says, you never have to live like that again. Newcomer says, thank God. How's that work? Why is that, you know? We don't know how it works, you know. We try to explain to people. You do that Monday. When you go to work Monday, right? Those of you got jobs. You go to work Monday. And they says, have a good weekend. Oh, had a great weekend. Oh, yeah, man, it was wonderful. Went down to big roundup there at Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in AA. Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, yeah, you wouldn't believe it, man. Went down there, this guy was talking. He was doing real good, and then he got drunk, and he lost his family, lost his business, lost his house, lost his marriage. Went to jail, rolled out of hot chest, went to jail. God, it was great. I said, you active in that deal? Oh, yeah. Got a sponsor and everything. Really? Who's your sponsor? Can't tell you, Anonymous. A lot like the guy that spoke, though. Man, my sponsor was doing great. Doing really good, and then he got drunk. He got drunk, rolled out of hot chest, had all kinds of trouble. You know, lost his family, lost his business, lost his car, lived outdoors. Ended up in the penitentiary. Spent 2 years in the penitentiary. Got out. Never did get sober. Kept getting drunk. Finally ended up in the state mental hospital. That's my sponsor. And I listen to every word he says. Why do you do that? Why do you do that? And yet that's what works. That's what works, you know. I love it when they talk about the books that, you know, that science may one day come out with a pill or something to help us. They haven't yet, you know, but they might. They're getting pretty close now. I've heard about that deal over there in Scandinavia or wherever it is. I want to tell you, if they come out with that pill, if they ever do come up with a pill that'll let you drink like a normal drinker, I ain't taking it. I don't think there's an alcoholic in this room that would take it. You really want to take a pill that's going to let you drink like a normal drinker? Hell. Why do you want to do that? I married a normal drinker. I don't want to drink like her. Oh, it's embarrassing to drink like that. It really is. I'm driving around. This was several years ago before we got married. I'm driving around. It was Saturday afternoon in Dallas, Texas, August. So it's hot in August. And she says, I kind of want a beer. Can we get a beer? And I said, yeah. I said, you can get a beer. You wanted me to go in a place or you wanted to get one to go? Or what? She says, no, just get one for the road on the way home. So I pulled up into the liquor joint. And I went in and got a six-pack of beer. Came out. She says, what are you doing? I said, well, you wanted a beer. She said, but you bought a six-pack. I said, I don't think they sell singles. Do they sell singles? I never bought a single in my life. So she drank her beer, and then that was in August. In Christmas time, we're over at her place. We're going to have a Christmas party, and I'm in the kitchen helping, and I open the refrigerator, and there are four bottles of beer on the bottom shelf. I said, no, that wouldn't be those. So I said, honey, what is this? She said, oh, that's my beer. Like she'd got her beer, you know. I said, what? Where'd you get that? She says, that's the beer you bought in August. She said, Daddy was up a little while ago watching a football game and had pizza and likes to have a beer this week. So he drank one. Hope that's okay. I said, this isn't wine. It doesn't get better with age, you know. You just got to drink the stuff, get it over with, you know. You want to drink like that? That's embarrassing. You know? Keep beer around like that. I had a buddy of mine invited me over to his party. He said, I don't want to drink like a normal drinker. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. And this buddy of mine invited me over to his house. And because I was single, he had this girl he wanted me to meet on Sunday. So I go over there. And they're going to barbecue, lay around the pool, and have a meet and eat deal. And so I go in there, and they're in the kitchen getting ready to go out. And they got one bucket and one bottle of champagne in the bucket. They're not alcoholic. And I said, Steve, what's this? He said, well, that's our champagne. The girls want to have mimosas Sunday afternoon. They're going to mix champagne with orange juice. Okay. I don't know. So I looked at him and said, get one bottle. I said, Steve, how many bottles y'all got? He gets a funny look on his face and he says, just the one. Why? I said, hell, it's your party. So we barbecue, we lay around the pool, we had a great afternoon, we're getting ready to leave at 6 o'clock, been there all afternoon at 6 o'clock, they're cleaning up in the kitchen. I go in the kitchen, all three of them gather around this bucket, fussing with this bucket. I said, what are y'all doing? Steve looks up and says, oh, John, you're an alcoholic, you know how to do this. How do we recork this bottle? I said, I don't have a clue how to recork that bottle. Did you ever have to recork a bottle in your life? Hell, I'm embarrassed. Three of them can't knock off one measly bottle of champagne all afternoon long. I drank a 12-pack of Diet Coke in the same time. And they can't knock off one bottle of champagne. Unbelievable. You want to drink like that? That sounds fun, doesn't it? Let's have a party and drink half a bottle of champagne. Crazy. That's crazy. See, I am an alcoholic, but I had a terrible time accepting that fact because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I started drinking when I was 25 for having my first drink. I'm drinking right off the bat, man. I'm drinking alcoholic. I never drank socially. I never got that cocktail or that glass of wine and walked around and watched the ice melt and then left. You know, I like to drink to get drunk. That's what I do. And right away, people are telling me that I got problems. And they're telling me I'm an alcoholic. I know. I said, what's an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? What is that? Don't get excited, John. It's a disease. Well, then fine, let's go get some medical diagnosis, find out. Well, no, we can't do that. Well, how do you know you're an alcoholic? Can't we go get some blood analysis done? No. Well, how do you know you're an alcoholic? What is an alcoholic? Can't we go get like a CAT scan or something like that to find out? No, can't do that. Well, how do you know you're an alcoholic? What's an alcoholic? So, yeah, here's the deal. You all want me to quit drinking. Okay, what happens 20 years from now if I find out I'm not an alcoholic? I've blown 20 years. I could have been drinking. I'm not going to take that kind of risk. Just not going to take that kind of risk. So they say, well, you drink too much. As soon as they told me I drank too much, I know I'm not an alcoholic. Because I never drank too much in my life. Never. There's not an alcoholic in this room today that ever drank too much. It's impossible for an alcoholic to drink too much. Can't do it. See, I am an alcoholic, but not because I drank too much. I'm an alcoholic because I couldn't drink enough. You ever drink enough? Oh, yeah, I can see somebody from this group. You go to the bar, you have a couple cocktails. Bartender says, you care for another cocktail? Oh, golly. Now, let's see. Today's Sunday. Tomorrow's Monday. I got work tomorrow. No, I think I've had enough. Never had enough. I mean, I go to the bar at noon. You ever do that? You get to the bar at noon, you start drinking at noon. It's now midnight. Been drinking 12 hours in the same bar. Right? And I'm drunk. And I know I'm talking about it. Just Stuart. God, I'm drunk. This is me too. Can I buy another drink? Hadn't had enough. Well, you can't drink enough. It's impossible to drink too much. See, normal drinkers, y'all know who you are. Those normal drinkers can drink enough. And so occasionally, but not very often, they might drink too much. But if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, you can't drink enough. It's impossible to drink too much. So when they tell me I drank too much, I know I'm not an alcoholic. So that's not my problem. My problem is that I drink too much. My problem is that I can't drink enough. Because when I drink, it's an incredible thing happens. When I drink, it's a little bomb explodes inside. And boy, it fills every empty pore I got. And I am happy, joyous, and free. And when I'm not drinking, man, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. I am restless, irritable, and discontent. But when I drink, I'm okay. And you want me to quit? Why would you quit? You're not going to quit with that. You know? In fact, when I drink, it's incredible what happens. When I drink, you know those promises in the book? Those promises come true in my life. Never fails. After that first drink, I begin to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Every time. I don't know about you, but after that second drink, I don't know what happens to you, but that fear of financial insecurity just kind of slips away. Yeah, we don't need money. I got checks. You know, we're okay. We're okay. After four or five drinks, I don't know about you, but I intuitively know how to handle situations that are baffling me. Happens every time I'm drinking. After seven or eight drinks, I really begin to comprehend the meaning of serenity. And after a dozen drinks or so, it becomes real clear for me that alcohol is doing for me what I can't do for myself. And you want me to quit? Why are you going to quit when it's doing that for you? Hell, you ain't going to quit. You know? And when they're telling me I'm an alcoholic and because I drink too much, it doesn't make any sense to me. And they don't know why I can't drink enough. I don't know how they can drink too much. They go, I can't do that. And finally, my brothers tell me, I'm getting all kinds of trouble. And my brother says, you better shut up and fly right. The folks think you're crazy. They're going to lock you up. And that's when I figured out my real deal. I did have some problems. But Utah, I'm living in Utah. I grew up in Utah. And it's at a high altitude. Y'all see the Winter Olympics 5 years ago? It's up in the mountains. Well, scientific fact, people who live at high altitudes for prolonged periods of time have much thinner blood than people who live at low altitudes. I saw that on Discovery Channel. I've been in Utah my whole life. I got to have thin blood. Well, if you've got a new party heart on thin blood, you have a problem. What I need to do is get to sea level, thicken up my blood, and I'd be able to be okay. So I moved to Seattle, that sea level. Had a buddy up there. I moved up there to see. And I wasn't doing anything, just doing a little drinking, working on thickening up my blood. And when you're in that kind of condition, the next logical thing you want to do is how you're going to want to gamble. Best time to gamble is when you're unemployed. And so I started to play poker up there. It was legal back then, 20, 25 years ago. And I finally thought, you know, when you're a hot shot and a high flyer like me, you want to be where the real action is. So I ran down to Nevada, ran around Las Vegas. And that's lower than sea level. That's, you get thick blood down there. Finally moved down there and ended up in Reno, Nevada. I wasn't doing anything, just doing a little drinking, playing a little poker, working on thickening my blood. Then buddy invited me to come back to Utah to party this club one night. I should have gone. I was doing real good in Utah, or in Reno. But I go back there and went to a place called One More Time Club. It's a great club. Met her. She was sitting in the bar waiting. They're always waiting for you at the bar. You know? Fell in love. She wouldn't go out with me, you know, till Monday. She was busy all weekend. Had, I was supposed to leave Sunday. Should have left Sunday. Stayed till Monday. We go out Monday night. It's a bad date. Terrible date. You know you got a bad date when you invite them to dinner and then they really want to eat. You know? So, because I never eat when I drink. So she's eating, I'm drinking. But I'm a gentleman, so every time I order me a whiskey or her glass of wine. Well, the woman ain't keeping up. Her wine's stacking up. Now, to keep from being embarrassed, I got to drink my whiskey and drink her wine. It was just a bad deal. And finally, she said, take me home, and I want to take her home. She had no fun that night. Took her home, dropped her off. Went over to Price, knocked on Price's door. And he opened the door. He said, I thought you had a date. I said, that damn woman. I went in there. I bought a gallon of wine. She said, she liked wine, so I bought a gallon. Walked in there. And that was October 6, 1981, that Monday. And we drank that wine. And I said, now tomorrow, Tuesday, October 7, 1981, we're going to hit this town one more time, then I'm out of here. This half to drink will get me in trouble. So we go out Tuesday, and we started the Joker Club. The Joker Club is not a private club or anything. You got to be a member of a private club and you start doing real drinking. They have these little beer bars, and they have the liquor joints, but they're private clubs. We go to this little beer joint, Joker Club. It wasn't a very fancy club. It was a beer bar. Okay, I'll be honest, it was a topless joint, okay? And what a very fancy topless joint. The Joker Club had one dancer in the whole place. One dancer. He had to be drunk to appreciate her. I mean, it was just... So we were in there, and then we went over to see the fashion at the Hilton, and then I blacked out. I black out a lot. Some blackouts are real scary. Some aren't too bad. There are two factors that determine how scary a blackout is. The first factor is how long are you blacked out. The longer you're blacked out, the scarier they are. And the second factor is what are you doing when you come out of your blackout? That adds to the factor of how scary it is. Well, I came out of my, I wasn't blacked out that long, a couple hours, but I came out of my blackout at the worst time, without a doubt, the worst time to come out of a blackout. Those of you who know the blackout know that the worst time to come out of a blackout is when you're talking to the cops. Because you don't know what you're talking about, you know? And you can't ask them, now, what are we doing here? You can't do that, you know? So you kind of got to figure out, what do they want? What do they ask for? What have I already admitted to? You got to figure all that out without asking any questions like that. It's just a terrible time coming out of a blackout. And I finally figured out they wanted my driver's license. I didn't have a driver's license. They'd taken that 3 DWIs earlier, right? So I told the guy, listen, I'm going over there. That's where I'm going to go. I'm going right. I'll bet that's where my driver's license is. I'll leave my car parked here, pick it up tomorrow. Thanks for stopping, but I'm going to go right over there. They would not let me go. They made me stay there until they ran my license plate, found out who I was, arrested me. Because I'm in lockup. And this time they're ticked. They're really mad. Because, see, I knew the system. I couldn't even bond out. I couldn't even put bond. Because I knew what the deal was. You get arrested, no matter what you're arrested for, you plead not guilty, right? Not guilty. Doesn't matter, not guilty. And then you go to the OR person back then in the 70s and early 80s, you go to the OR and they let you out on your OR. It's just drunk stuff. I think the biggest bond I ever posted was $50. And so you get out in your OR, you plead not guilty, get out in your OR, and then they set a court date, and then you get to an attorney, and then you start that famous postponing process, right? Postpone. You keep postponing. What you're doing is you're hoping the cop dies. That's what's really, you just have him die so he can't show up in court, you know? Mine never died, they always show up in court. So the attorney says after 9 months of postponing, he says, okay, tomorrow we go to court, no more postponing, we go to court tomorrow, I'll be there at 10 o'clock. You want to be sure the day before court, move. Okay? I just moved, I never went to court, I just moved. So I had all these failure to appears. And they said, no, you're not getting out, you're going to court. So I'm in lockup, don't like lockup, don't like nothing about lockup, one out, can't get out. Finally, a friend of mine named Stan. Stan comes down to see me. Stan's not an alcoholic. Don't think about AA or Alcoholics Anonymous or alcoholism or nothing. But he was a very dear friend, had a lot of money, knew some people, some influence. He comes down to see me and says, okay, he said, I can get you out. But the only way I'll do that is if you promise me you'll get some treatment. I've talked to some people that will release you into my custody. But the only way I'm going to do that is if you promise me you'll get some treatment because you're sick and you need help. And I said, oh, Stan, bless you. Boy, you are so right. I don't know what it is. I go down there, I get down to those bars, I get drunk down there, I get all messed up, and I get in trouble. I don't want to, I guess I'm an alcoholic, Stan, and I need help. He says, I'll get you out. So I got out of jail. I had no intention of not drinking. I didn't want to quit. I'm not going to quit. I'm just getting out of jail. And I'll do or say anything to get out of jail. I figured that's a lot better than being in jail. So I got out of jail, I had to stay with Stan. The next day he throws me in the yellow pages, says, you're going to where you want to go, but you're going to treatment. So I looked in the yellow pages, and they had a lot of treatment centers. And I called up one treatment center, and I said, I need to come in for a little treatment. Yeah, I said, okay. She said, do you have any insurance? I said, no, I don't have any. I hadn't worked for 3.5 years. I don't have any insurance. She said, well, it's $12,000. I said, hell, I don't want to stay all year. I mean, $12,000, this was in 81. $12,000 in 81. Incredible. It was very fresh. I called this one place. They wanted $18,000. I said, honey, listen, if I had $18,000, I wouldn't need your goddamn treatment. That'd solve any problem I had. Just give me the money. I'll solve my problems. I don't need to go to treatment. What is that deal all about? It's crazy. So I found a couple of one place. I said, I need to come in for a little treatment. The gal said, okay. And I said, well, I don't have an insurance. She said, okay. I said, how much is it? So she's going to give me benefits first, right? Salesperson, benefits first. So she says, well, when you check in here, you get room, board, and therapy. We have two kinds of therapy. We have individual therapy, and we have group therapy. You get both those, and it's $9 a day. And when you check in here, we apply for food stamps. We get the food stamps to the bill. And then if you do some work around here, we get some state aid. We pay $1.50 a day, which you can buy cigarettes with. You can apply that to the bill. If you apply that to the bill and all the food stamps, you get down to be about $5 a day. I couldn't believe it. I said, how long is your waiting list? So those other places that want 12, 18,000, they had 30 to 60 day waiting list just to get in. I said, how long is your waiting list? She said, well, we have a bed for you tonight. Well, I don't need to come tonight. You know? She said, I think you got to come tonight. And I got a problem with this place. Think about that. They got bargain rates, $9 a day, room board therapy. They can't fill their beds. Now they're high-pressing me to get me to come in. Okay, I'm the consumer here. I got my rights. I said, honey, listen, you make my reservation for Saturday. Or just forget the whole damn deal. So she made it for Saturday. And I didn't drink. I stayed with Stan. Hung out with Stan. Saturday came. I drove down there. Parked in the parking lot. Sat in that parking lot of that treatment center for all morning long. Watched him go in and out of there. In and out of there. I want to see what kind of person goes to a $9 a day jitter joint, you know? So they're going in and out of there. In and out of there. You know those guys going in there? Needed to go in there. They look like alcoholics. Supposed to look. They didn't look like y'all look. Y'all don't look like alcoholics. Those guys going there look like alcoholics. Look at that guy going there. He needs to be in there. Good heavens, look at that guy. He's an alcoholic. You can look at that guy, he's an alcoholic. And I wasn't an alcoholic, but it fit my budget, so I checked in. And nothing happened. Filled out a whole bunch of papers. Got my room. It was a nice place, clean place. And next day was Sunday. I had my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. Two guys from outside came in. We sat around lunch tables. There were 36 of us, all men, 36 of us in the lunchroom. Sitting around lunch tables, and these two guys came in from AA, had the first meeting there. Don't know what they said, didn't listen to a thing they said. They talked for a long time. I'm watching everybody else. I'm watching everybody else in that trip is, how do you do AA? Because I'm a real chameleon, right? I'm going to figure out how you do AA, then I'm going to be able to do AA. So I'm watching what everybody else does. Nobody wanted to be there. They weren't paying a bit of attention. They're smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee. So I just smoked cigarettes, drank coffee, watched them. These two guys got through talking, started down the road, discussion meetings. First guy introduced himself, said, my name's Joe B. I'm an alcoholic. I'll just pass. Second said, I'm Jim S. I'm an alcoholic. I'll pass. I caught on real quick. What they do in AA, you give your first name, last initial, admit to the group you're alcoholic, and then pass. Right? Because if the meeting ends, it's over. So if everybody passes, you can get out of there in 35 minutes, you know? So it came around to me. I did it right. I said, my name's John A. I'm an alcoholic, and I'll pass. Nothing happened. That must be the deal. See, because they had it written on the wall, admit you're powerless over alcohol. So if you admit you're an alcoholic to this group, it'll take that burden of alcoholism off your shoulders. Sit over there. That's got to be what it is. I did it right. Nothing happened. But, well, obviously, Alcoholics Anonymous is only for real simple-minded people. Just simple-minded people, that's all. And besides, I'm not a real alcoholic anyway. Now, as distorted a perception that is of Alcoholics Anonymous, that was my perception of AA. It ain't for me. Okay? That was my first meeting of Alcoholics. Now, next day was Monday. Dale came in. Dale was my counselor. Had my first counseling session with Dale. She wanted me to stay 2 months. Dale. I've been here all weekend, okay? Been talking to these guys. They've told me they're alcoholics. So I have no reason to doubt they probably are. They look like they're alcoholics. Okay, and they've told me how this program works. How that first month you're going to break me down. You're going to get me to be open and honest. We can save a month right there. I've always been open and honest in everything I do. You know, and I do real well in school. I got a quick mind. Still trapped. Remembers almost photographic memory. Remembers everything. And I read real fast. You get my manuscripts out of school, they'll tell you. And I'm too busy to stay 2 months. Cannot stay 2 months. She says, you're busy? I said, yes. She looks through her papers. So she says, now where were you working? Said, well, I'm not working, but I'm busy. You know? Isn't that true about alcoholics? We're the most busy, unemployed people you ever want to meet in your life. We really are. Go to the meeting tomorrow, right? Go to the meeting on Monday. Now the guy's unemployed. He's got nothing to do but get to the meeting, and he's late. He said, where have you been? Hell, I've been busy. I don't know what we do, but we're busy doing it, you know. And so I said, I'll give you 2 weeks. Because, see, I'm not going to quit drinking. That's what I'm doing there. I just figured treatment time is better than jail time. So I said, I'll give you 2 weeks, and then I'm going to be out of here. So you give me whatever you're going to study during that two-month period. I'll read ahead. You know, you can give me pop quizzes if you want, because I'm out of here 2 weeks. So she listens to all that BS line. She says, well, we better hurry with you. I said, damn right, we better hurry with me. That was my first exposure to Dale, my counseling session. Next day was alcoholic education. Next day was group therapy. I love group on Tuesday. Group was great. Wednesday was alcoholic education seminar. That day they were showing a movie. Now, I'm not impressed with movies about drug addiction and alcohol. They're boring. Even today, they're boring to me. You know? I'd seen Days of Wine and Roses. That's fine. So I'm watching this movie. And the name of the movie was I'll Quit Tomorrow. And I'm watching it, in all my pride, all my ego, all my contempt. And I'm watching this movie. It tore me apart. I couldn't believe that. It was like I related to everything in that movie. It was like they'd made a movie of my life, and they were showing it to the group. I did everything that guy did. I talked the way the guy talked. I acted the way the guy acted. I dressed the way the guy dressed. I drank. I drank the way the guy drank. I did everything that guy did. I related to everything. And as I related to it, I knew the gig was up. That was my moment of clarity when I knew the gig was up. What happened to me that night is I quit looking for that definition. What's an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? What is that? What is an alcoholic? Quit looking for that definition. See, I later found out in AA, we don't have a definition of an alcoholic. What we have is a description. So you can't argue with the description of an alcoholic. You can argue with the definition. That's why Webster's got 10 definitions for every word, right? But you can't argue with the description. The most powerful tool God has given Alcoholics Anonymous is our description of the alcoholic. Because it's that description that seems to have the power to literally strip everything that separates the alcoholic from himself. And I can see me in that like I've never seen me. as I related to that movie. I could see me that light like my mom saw me. I could see me that light like my ex-wife saw me. The difference was I could see me, and I knew the gig was up. It was my moment of clarity. Think how important that description is. Two-thirds of our book, two-thirds of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is what? Descriptions of alcoholics in the stories. I mean, why'd they put all those stories in there? Just to make a big book? No. It's that important, you know? Because that description that seems to have the power to strip everything that separates the alcoholic from himself as he relates to it. So the kind of talked about last night, you know, as he relates to it. And I knew the gig was up. But I wasn't happy about it. Sometimes you'll hear people from the podium say how, when they finally found out they're alcoholic, how relieved they were and how at home they felt. Thank God, I'm at home. That was not my experience. I was petrified. I cried all night. Because, I mean, it just hit me. I am an alcoholic. My God, I'm an alcoholic. My whole life just changed. I mean, like, I got to go get a job. You know? How am I going to function in this world? I don't know how to function in. I cried, I'm scared to death. I'm an alcoholic. Now what do I do? I can't drink now. What am I going to be able to do? How am I going to function in this world that scares me to death without drinking? I cried all night, and I stayed there 2 months. Now, 6 weeks. Couldn't stay 2 months. Too busy. stay 2 months. But I did stay 6 weeks. And I got out of there the 1st of December. And when I left there, they said, now, John, you need aftercare. Very important part of treatment is aftercare. But you're living in Reno, 800 miles away. You can't come back 3 times a week for aftercare. So we're going to prescribe you go to AA for your aftercare. Here's intergroup's phone number. Call them when you get back to Reno. So I got back to Reno the 1st of December. I knew two things when I got back there. I knew I was alcoholic and didn't want to drink. I know that. I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to drink. Second thing I knew was AA's got nothing to offer. I mean, because you go there, you give your first name, last initial, admit you're alcoholic, and then pass. Okay? How silly can that be? You know, we say it over and over and over again. I don't want to do that. You know, but I don't want to drink. So the first time back in town, I call AA on the phone, intergroup. The guy answered the phone. I said, my name's John A. I'm alcoholic. The guy says, I'm Bruce. John, I'm alcoholic. What do you need? What can I help you with? And I said, well, Bruce, listen, I just got out of treatment over in Salt Lake City. I'm living here in Reno, Nevada, and I, you know, just want to call and report in. I thought they had me on computer, you know. If you don't check in, they put out a failure to appear on you, but a warrant. Guy didn't report in. So he said, well, I'm glad you're here. He said, you want to go to a meeting tonight? It was Thursday night. I said, yeah, I go to a meeting. He said, well, we got a men's stag at the Hotel Riverside Casino. Third floor starts at 8:30 on Thursday. I said, I don't know where it is. I'll be there. I'll be there early so we can meet. He said, well, I'm not going to go. I said, well, you know, call them and tell them John A. is coming to their meeting tonight. He said, don't worry, they'll be there. So I show up, 7:45, first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I called, made a reservation. Guy did not follow through, tell him I'm coming. Nobody's sitting there saying, oh, you must be John A. Here's your seat, coffee. No, just some guys smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, waiting for the meeting. I got my coffee, sat down. Pretty soon, a little guy named Red got up to chair the meeting. Red's passed on now, but Red looked like an alcoholic. He talked for a long time, didn't listen to a thing Red said, because I'm watching everybody else. How did they do AA in Reno? They did the same way they did treatment. Nobody paid a bit of attention. They just drank coffee, just smoked cigarettes. But Red got through talking. They started down the row. It was a discussion meeting. And these guys talked. They didn't pass. They were talking. Don't know what they're talking about. There's nothing we talked about in treatment. In fact, these guys were so bad, they couldn't even introduce themselves right. Some of them did not give their last initial. They just said, my name's John, I'm an alcoholic. Guy didn't give his last initial. You're supposed to give your last initial here. Guy didn't give his last initial. Some of them gave their last name. They said, my name's John Allred, I'm an alcoholic. Jesus. What does he think anonymous means, man? It's an anonymous program. He's given his last name. I could look him up in the phone book now. Incredible, huh? So that, you know what? If he's not going to respect his anonymity, I will. I won't look at the guy. I won't look at you. I don't know who you are. If I see you on the street, I won't say hi. This is an anonymous program. Yeah, unbelievable. So they're talking about stuff. I have no idea what they're talking about. Nothing we talk about in treatment. I mean, it became real clear to me, these guys have not been to treatment. I mean, I sat half through that meeting. Nobody mentioned we got an XY chromosome deficiency. How are they staying sober? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So it got to me, I thought I'd help. So I did a write to her. I said, my name is John A., and I'm an alcoholic. And then I qualified. I said, listen, guys, I just got out of treatment over here in Salt Lake City. And I want you to know I have the latest, most up-to-date medical and psychological information. So my second resentment, Red cut me off, said, thank you, John. We're on the next guy. I thought, son of a bitch is jealous. I know stuff he doesn't know. You know, after meeting some guys, come up and shook my hand and said, John, we hope you come back. I said, I'll be back. They need me down there, you know? Now, Chuck Chamberlain used to always say, every man's my teacher. Some people teach me what to do. Some people teach me what not to do. Okay, if you're new, please keep in mind, most of what I share is what not to do. Because I've done this deal all wrong, all wrong. I don't know where I was when they said 90 meetings in 90 days. I didn't do that. Didn't hear that. What I did one meeting a week. Every Thursday night, I'm down in my men's stag group. Now, there's a lot, let me share. But I keep going back. I figure I'm a hell of a lot younger than Red. He's going to die, then I get to share. You know? So let me tell you what happens when you go to one meeting a week if you haven't done that program. They told me in treatment, which is true, they said, John, don't drink, okay? If you just don't drink, you're going to feel better. And that's true. But see, nobody explained to me what that meant. If you don't drink, you will feel better. You're going to feel everything better. You're going to feel all the pain, all the anger, all the resentment. You're going to feel that shit a whole lot better, you know? And that's when I drink, when I feel better. I walk around, you know, feeling better, going nuts, you know? That's what happens to you. So I'm down at my men's stag meeting on Thursday. It was New Year. It was Christmas Eve that Thursday. Tomorrow's Christmas Day. They said, now, tomorrow's Christmas Day. Those of you got nowhere to go for Christmas dinner, you can go to the Dryers Club, Skid Row Clubhouse over on Wells Street. Still there. You can go over there and have free dinner. If you got nowhere to go, it starts about noon, Christmas Day. Well, I had nowhere to go at Christmas, so I went over to the Dryers Club. I found it. Went in there, ate. It was good. I'm sitting there not bothering anybody, not bothering a soul. Smoke a cigarette, drink a cup of coffee. Old-timer spotted me. You know when they spot you, their eyes get big and kind of glaze over. A newcomer, you know? They start to salivate, you know? So Don gets up and comes walking over to her man. I saw him coming. I thought, oh, God, look at this. Look at this guy here. He's not my kind of guy. This guy's an old guy. I mean, I like cool guys. This guy's fat, old guy. Nothing cool about him at all. He's got funny hair, big nose. Not my kind of guy. He introduces himself, says, my name's Don. And he let me know that he was the coordinator of intergroup. I didn't know what that was, but I thought, well, I'm glad they found something for you to do. You know? So we're talking to Don. It became clear. I've talked to Don for just a few minutes. Don had not been to treatment. Okay? So I started telling Don about all the stuff that they don't let me talk about in my group. He gets a funny look on his face and says, you want to go to a meeting with me tonight? And I said, well, hell, Don, it's Friday. I go Thursdays over to stag group. He says, we got a meeting every night in Reno. And in that month I've been going to AA, there's three meetings I've been to, I had heard something about spirituality. This is a spiritual program. Okay, it's a spiritual program. It is Christmas. I can go twice this week, won't hurt at all. So Don comes, gets me. We've got a state hospital. They got a meeting out there at 7 o'clock on a Friday night. And they give you a raffle ticket. And when you walk in there, you get that raffle ticket, and it doesn't mean they raffle off a big book, or as Bill sees it, whatever you want to pick. And so I got my raffle ticket, walked into that meeting, women in the meeting. First meeting I've been to was women in the meeting. I didn't know that it meant. I really didn't. I thought it was a men's deal. You know, I've been to men's drought joint, men's stag meeting, now we got women in the meeting. Why am I going Thursday when I come here Friday? Immediately adopt that in my home group. I said, this is my new home group, baby. I'll be back here next Friday, you know? This makes all the sense in the world to me now. About a spiritual awakening one more time. It's just wonderful. So they had a meeting. I don't know what they talked about because I'm busy praying. Because I had this great mind to read real fast. I had forgot to get a big book. Okay. I thought, this is it, man. It's Christmas Day. I'm the only guy without a big book. I'm winning the book. This is going to be God's gift to me on Christmas Day. I'm winning this book. I'm praying hard, man. By the time that meeting's over, God, give the book nobody but me. Nobody's been praying like I've been praying. I want the book. The book's mine. So they mean they had the raffle, off the big book. Third resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some little greater lady, 25 years sober, wins my book. I thought, what's she doing winning my book? Woman's got five home collecting desks. Came to see the Reed soul win my book. I'm storming out. Before I get out of there, that little lady comes up and gives me that book. That's where I got my book. And I took that book home, and I used to always say I took the book home that night and I read it from cover to cover. So if you ever heard me say that, or if you ever get hold of an old tape where I said that on the tape, please believe me that when I said that, hell, I believed it. And then I got involved in a big book study. You wouldn't believe the chapters they got in that book. You know, they got a chapter in the book, you know, chapter to the wives. Well, I wasn't a wife, didn't have a wife, didn't want a wife. So I didn't read that chapter. They got a chapter in the book, chapter to the employer. Hell, I'm not an employee. Didn't read that chapter. They got a chapter in the book, chapter to the agnostic. I'm not an agnostic, I knew God real well. Didn't read that chapter. Well, I want to tell you, if you just read, you know, chapter 3 and chapter 5, you read that book and it won't take you long to do it. Really, really won't. The next day, Don calls me up, takes me to, every day this guy's calling me on the phone, taking me to a meeting. And I don't really want to go. But he doesn't ask. He just calls me and says, pick you up in 20 minutes. Put, make the phone. But how's he know I want to go? I don't want to go to a meeting. I'm not going to go to a meeting. Every damn day? No, I'm not going to. Then I thought, wait a minute. You know what? This is the only guy talking to me in AA. If I don't go, what's he going to say about me behind my back? I got to go. Got to go. Take me to the meeting, you know. So this guy take me. An interesting thing happened. I didn't have a sponsor. Hadn't worked any steps. But it was fascinating what happened to me. The only change in my life is I'm going to a meeting every single day. And I not only feel better, but I start to feel good. And I hadn't felt those two things at the same time in years. The only change is a meeting every day. And all of a sudden, sobriety started putting on flesh and bones. And I started to meet other alcoholics and started getting involved in the thing. And I started to get excited about going to these meetings. And it was embarrassing. It really was. I mean, Don would come by and get me, and we're driving in the car, and I'm sitting in the front seat feeling like a little kid. I'd say, Don, do you think we can go get ice cream tonight? We'll see. But I started hanging out in an intergroup. I'd go to an intergroup during the day, and I'd drink coffee in an intergroup, meet other alcoholics, and I'd go out to ice cream afterward. I started to get excited about this thing. I started to put on flesh, meeting other alcoholics. I'm down in an intergroup a week later. It'd only been a week, and it was Thursday. I'm going to my men's stag meeting Thursday night. It was New Year's Eve. And the phone rings intergroup. I grabbed the phone. Young kid named Glenn. Glenn, 17 years old, wants to know how to stay sober New Year's Eve. I said, why? Damn, Glenn, it's New Year's Eve. You're 17, okay? We're open tomorrow. You can call tomorrow. We'll tell you all about it tomorrow, you know? Don grabs that phone away from me. That's when he passed the rule at Central Office. You have to have 6 months sobriety or longer to answer the phone. Don't you near the phone now if you don't have that. You got a big sign up there. Must have 6 months to answer this phone, you know? Don talked to him for a while. Gave him his phone number, not give him my phone number. But the next day, Don calls me and said, hey, Glenn, stay sober. Last night, wants to go to a meeting today. I'll pick you up. So my first 12-step call. This is great. So Don gets me. We go get Glenn. We're taking Glenn out to the hospital. And damn it, Don's just driving the car. He's not preparing Glenn for AA. I got to do it all. I just got to do it all here. So I start telling Glenn all about Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to love this meeting, Glenn. I said, you get women your first meeting, okay? I didn't know they were here for months, but you get women right out of the shooter. And I want to tell you, I've been to several groups here in Reno. This group's got the best looking women. You want to come back here next Friday night with me? We'll come here together next Friday night. And then when you get there, Glenn, they're going to give you a raffle ticket. Hang on the raffle ticket, because it doesn't mean they're going to raffle off a big book or as Bill sees it. And if God loves you, you'll win the book. You know? Donna said, well, Don just drives to the meeting. So we get to the meeting, we get a raffle ticket, we sit down. I'm busy praying for Glenn. I don't know what to talk about because I'm praying, come on, God, let Glenn win that book. If Glenn can just win that book. That'll be proof, you know, that God is working in his life. He'll stay sober forever. Not that it really matters, but, you know, I would have 100% 12-step call success rate. I can write articles in the grapevine, how to have 100% 12-step call success rate. It'd just be a wonderful time. And so I'm praying for Glenn. Then they went to have the raffle. We all stood up. They had the raffle. I won the big book. Don turned to me and says, yeah, that works. So, yeah, I signed it, gave it to Glenn. That's where Glenn got his big book. Okay? And Glenn's sober today because I gave him that big book. That's why he's sober today. Now, that little experience early in my sobriety taught me a lot because it taught me how God works. See, God works through people. Whenever God works, it's a win-win situation. Always two winners. It's a win-win deal with God. Everybody wins with God. It's a win-win deal. So I could have won the big book the first night. There'd been one winner, me. But that little old lady won by being able to share with me, and I won by being able to receive from her. God works through people. Always two winners when God works. A week later, two winners. I won by being able to share with Glenn. Glenn won by being able to receive from me. God works through people. See, by working through people, he gets twice the result for the same effort. Very efficient God. Very efficient guy. It also taught me how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Alcoholics Anonymous is one drunk sharing with another. And when that happens, that's the magic to our program. When one drunk shares. And there are two winners. The drunk doing the sharing, the drunk doing the receiving. See, I've told that story thousands of times in 25 years. And every time I share that, I remember that moment of clarity when I'm sitting there in the treatment center watching that movie. I remember that moment of clarity. I know that everyone here tonight, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, has had that moment of clarity. I'm equally convinced that those that come to AA for a while and leave right after drinking and dying tonight have had that moment of clarity. What's the difference between those of us that are here sober and those of us that have come and left? We both had that moment of clarity. I think what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is really pretty simple. What we do in here is we keep that moment alive. That moment of clarity is God's gift. And all we do in here is we keep it alive. She says, I've shared my moment with you and I've kept my moment alive of what it was like and what happened. What have you thought about? And when I'm on that side of the podium, one of y'all is up here and you're remembering your moment, you're sharing what it was like and what happened, you're keeping your moment alive. By the way, isn't this the perfect program for people whose root problem is they're selfish, self-centered? Because when you're up here and you're remembering your moment, I'm so self-centered, what am I thinking about? Screw your deal. You know, I had that. You know, we keep that moment alive. And nowhere can you keep that moment alive but when one alcoholic shares with another. We keep it alive. It's a win-win deal. You can't keep that moment alive by sharing with your therapist. It ain't a win-win deal. My life depends on hearing about your moment so that my moment stays alive. You can't keep that moment alive by sharing with your doctor. Your doctor doesn't need to hear about it. I need to hear about it. My life depends on hearing about your moment so that my moment stays alive. We keep that moment alive. Because what happens when you lose your moment? You take drunk. That moment of clarity is what God's gift is. And it's such a miracle that it normally happens before you get to AA. We assume you've had that when you show up here. And the proof of that statement is your last drink. I'm going to bet a whole lot of money. When you had your last drink, you sat it down, you had no idea that was your last drink. I didn't. Hell, if I would have, I'd have done it different, you know? But what happened? Something happened. It's called divine intervention. And that's what always happens to the alcoholic. We always have that opportunity. And what we do with that opportunity is what makes some stay and some leave. And in here, we keep that moment alive. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that it's one drunk sharing with another. Why does it work? Don't have a clue. Can't explain why it works. But there's a connection there that always happens when one alcoholic shares with another. And it's an incredible experience. My time in Alcoholics Anonymous has been just an incredible, incredible experience. Highs and lows. I don't know why, but when I came in today and I got sober, I thought, well, you know, if I stay sober and don't drink, my life is going to be wonderful. You know, I won't have any pain, won't have any problems. And I don't know why I always associated pain with being sick, but I always did. I always associated that if I'm in pain, I must be sick. You know? And I remember when I got divorced, I was 9 years sober. I was living in Dallas, Texas, and it was very painful. I remember going to my sponsor's house and crying, because it hit me in waves. I'd be down the road, and it would hit me in waves, and I'd start to cry uncontrollably. And I would go over there, and I'd say, you know, I've done everything you sons of bitches have told me to do. When am I going to get well? And my sponsor said, why do you think you're sick? And I said, because the book tells me so. He said, oh, it does? Where does it say that? I said, right there where it says it's a spiritual axiom, or I'm disturbed, or it says something wrong with me. He said, yeah. He said, there's something wrong with you, all right? You got divorced, and you're mourning, you're in a lot of pain. Does that mean you're sick? Why are you associating pain with being sick? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, if they call me on the phone right now and they tell me my son has been killed in an automobile accident, that's going to hurt. Does that mean I'm sick? Does it mean I haven't accepted that? See, there's a big difference between pain and being sick. And I used to think that if I accepted a fact, it wouldn't hurt anymore. And I'm a big believer in the old page 449. You know, that acceptance is the solution to all my problems, because I finally found out what acceptance was. Acceptance doesn't change the way you feel at all. It changes what you do. It changes the way you act. It doesn't change the way you feel. When I accepted my alcoholism, did I still have a desire to drink? Sometimes I did. Dr. Bob did for 2 years. Had a compulsion to drink. But his actions changed. And he didn't drink. And when I accept something, it's still going to hurt. But my actions are going to change. And eventually my emotions will catch up to my actions. You know? And so when I got divorced, I was going through all that pain. I didn't know what to do. And so they said, well, when all else fails, you need to start working with other alcoholics. So I started attending a lot of newcomers meetings. And I worked with a lot of newcomers. And I attend these meetings, and these newcomers would be there. And problem is, after the meeting, I'd go up and give them my card. So anything I can do for you, give me a call. Problem when you do that, they start to call you. You know? So I started sponsoring all these newcomers, you know. And they would come in there, and they would call me on the phone, and they were all just right out of treatment, and they're all whacked out, and they'd come in the phone, and they'd say, John, if you're going to help me, you need to know a little bit about me. And I'd say, okay, I plan on getting to know a lot about you. Well, you need to know some of my core issues. I didn't know what those were. Your core issues? Yeah, I didn't have any core issues. You have core issues? I thought I was an alcoholic. That was my core issue. Now, I come from a very dysfunctional family. And because of that, being a broken home, I was very dysfunctional. I never had any proper role models, so I never learned to set any proper boundaries. And because of never learning to set proper boundaries, I had terrible abandonment issues. And because of those abandonment issues, I have a sex addiction that's just driving me crazy. I'd be exhausted. We've only talked to them on the phone for 5 minutes. I'm exhausted. We got to get together. So they come over to the house, and they bring all their books with them, you know, all their books that they got out of treatment and all that stuff, and this new stuff going on. And I want to tell you what happens. You want to get into all that new stuff? Let me tell you what happened to you. You'll relate. Because it's basically what they've done very conveniently, and they did it mainly because of money. I was in the insurance business at the time, and the insurance companies found out, they did a lot of studying on that, because they were putting $250,000 into alcoholics into treatment, and we were still getting drunk. And they kept saying, man, we put a lot of money into these guys, and they keep getting drunk. And they evaluated, and they found out that if they send them to treatment, they have the same recovery rate as if they just walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. With no treatment. Just walk through the doors of AA, they got the same percentage recovery. So they said, what we're going to do is we're going to change the definition and make it a mental disorder. We're going to make alcoholism a mental disorder so that they have $5,000 lifetime benefit for alcoholism. And so that's what they did. Well, the treatment center said, well, we can't get these people, we can't, you know, house them for the time and treat them for $5,000. That's what we're going to pay for alcoholism. So they said, well, it's a mental disorder. How about depression? Can we get $5,000 for depression? Oh, yeah, we'll pay you $5,000 for depression. Okay, now we got $10,000. How about anxiety disorder? Can we get $5,000 for anxiety disorder? Yeah, we can pay you $5,000 for anxiety disorder. Now we're up to $15,000. So they've taken all of our character defects and our shortcomings and made them disorders. So no wonder you relate to them. You got them all. But it's no longer a character defect. It's a disorder that they will treat. and they get paid for it that way. And the proof of that statement is, if you don't believe me, anybody that's been to treatment in the last 15 years, when you got treatment, you had more than one thing wrong with you, didn't you? Nobody comes out with just one thing wrong. Because you only got 5,000 for that. You got to have a bunch wrong with you to stay in the place, right? And so that's what's happened. It's very simple. It's very simple. Just follow the money. And so all these guys come over and bring all those books to me, and I'm sitting there, I'm reading this stuff. I'm no doctor. They're on their latest antidepressant that they got going. They're reading all this stuff. They keep getting drunk. Nobody's getting well. I'm getting sick. I'm in a ton of pain. Now my guys I'm sponsoring, trying to help, they're getting drunk, and I'm getting sick. I go to my sponsor, and I said, okay, this ain't working. My program is not working. It's not working. My program's not working. He looked at me and he said, well, why don't you try ours? And then he asked me some key questions. He said, John, he said, how many people under a year are you sponsoring? I said, 14. He said, any of them getting well? I said, no. And I'm getting sick. Then he asked me a key question. He said, were you passing on them the same program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was passed on to you? And I wasn't. I hadn't given them the same opportunity y'all gave me. And I had to go to those guys and make amends to them, and knowing that most of them would have to leave and go find other sponsorship, and hopefully they'd get the deal and get sober. And I don't know if any of them that are, you know. But I don't want anybody to leave tonight, today, and not know the program of AA that was passed on to me. Because that's what I'm responsible for. When a newcomer reaches out, that the hand of AA be there to pass on the same program that was passed on to me. Okay? And the program that's passed on to me of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't say a damn thing that I have to learn to deal with or control or manage any issues whatsoever. In fact, it says you can't do it. If you could have managed your issues, you would have done it 25 years ago and you wouldn't be in AA today. You're in AA because you can't do that. We don't come to AA to learn how to manage our life better. I don't call my sponsor to learn how to manage my life better. My sponsor is not a fire chief that puts out fires. AA is not a firehouse that we run to when our hair's on fire because we've screwed up and how do we get out of the trap one more time. That's not what we do in AA. In AA, we have a program that teaches us not to build fires. You know? It's going to change everything in our life where we don't play with matches. And you know what? You're going to play with me, you're going to get burned, and when you do, we're going to love you back. But we have a program that's going to enable you to find a power greater than yourself to solve your problem. There's a big difference between learning to surrender and learning to manage. We don't learn to manage our problems any better in here than we did before we started drinking. We're going to have to learn to surrender our problems to a power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem. So what we do in here is we find that power that's going to solve our problem. Now, that only applies if you believe in God. If you believe that God really loves you so much and is so concerned about you as a person that he's personally going to get involved in your life directly and solve your problem. Do you believe that? Or is that just AA podium rhetoric that we use to make each other feel better when we can't do anything about the problem we're in? You know? Does God love you that much that he's personally going to get involved in your life to handle your problems? Or is this whole thing just a coincidence? I'm sitting in Dallas, Texas, 23 years ago. I'm only 2 years sober. I'm leaving birthday party at Dallas North. 200 people at birthday night. And I'm only 2 years sober. Joanne's working the front desk. Joanne grabs me for some reason out of those people. Joanne grabs me and says, listen, there's a little lady in San Antonio that called. She's crying. Her husband, her boy lives up here in Dallas. He's suicidal. He's going to kill himself. He's been drinking and drugging for a couple weeks. He's going to kill himself. She wants to know if somebody can go help him because he's suicidal. So I called her first, told her who it was, and I said, we're not supposed to go unless the boy calls. She said, he can't, he's too messed up. He's been awake for 2 weeks. He's been drinking and drugging. He's so disoriented, but he could remember his mama's number. And he called his mom and said, Mama, can you send somebody for help? I'm going to kill myself. She was crying. She said, I can't get up there. Can you go get my boy and save my boy's life? So she gave me his number, and I called him on the phone, told him who it was, and I said, you want some help? He said, yeah. He said, I'm not going to make it. I'm so disturbed, I can't tell you where I am. He said, what's your address? He said, oh, I can't. You'll never find me. I only live on a street 2 blocks long. It's brand new. It's not even in Mapsco yet. You'll never find me. I can't tell you how to get here. I'm too messed up. I said, give me your damn address. I'll find you. So he gave me his address. It was Dome Street. Now I've asked this question for 25 years. Every month I give the steps in Dallas, Texas, and I've asked them, that's thousands and thousands of drunks I've asked, does anybody know in this group know where Dome Street is? Nobody in 25 years has ever said, I know where Dome Street is. It's only 2 blocks long. Back then it was a brand new street. Very hard to find. But see, I know where Dome Street is. I have a client that lives on Dome Street. He not only lives on Dome Street, he's literally the next door neighbor, the guy making the phone call. I said, I'm right where you are. I'll be there in 5 minutes. I grabbed Tom, a guy sponsored, we're going to make that 12-step call. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. God ain't personally getting involved in our life. He's not going to provide just the right person at just the right time with just the right information, since God works through people. Right? You know the odds of that? Lady in San Antonio calls Directory of Information for AA. We got 150 groups in Dallas, Texas. But for some reason, the operator picks Dallas North. 200 people in the group. I'm only 2 years sober, but for some reason, Joanne picks me to make that 12-step call. And I know where Dome Street is. Just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. He's not going to put just the right person, just the right time, just the right information. A little while later, I'm going out to California on a business trip. I get out there, the plane's been delayed. They come back an hour later and they say the plane's been canceled. Can't go on this plane, but there's a plane 2 gates down going to California. You can go on that standby. So 100 of us run down there. There's only 17 seats on the plane left. I'm the second last guy to get on the plane. I get on the plane, I go back there. This is where you can smoke on planes, in the smoking section. There's one seat left next to the window. Right next to that is on the aisle. It's a good-looking gal in a red dress. God has worked in my life today. Yeah. So I sit down, and she's a chatterbox. Just chatter, 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 chatter. I said, I've not had enough coffee for this woman, you know. She's chatter. So the plane takes off. She finally shuts up. She pulls out her needle point. She's needle pointing. I look over. She's needle pointing the Serenity Prayer. I said, that was my turn. So I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm needlepoint. I said, I know you're needlepoint, but what is that you're needlepointing? She's embarrassed. She didn't want to show me. So she's real busy now. Her hands are getting... I said, what are you doing? So she finally holds up and says, well, they call it the Serenity Prayer. And I went, oh, man, are you one of those Jesus freaks? She says, no. But I'm trying to be spiritual. I said, really? She said, yeah. So she's, now she knows I'm watching. Her hands are sweaty. She's going real fast. I said, you're really good at that. She said, Mom, I shouldn't do this. I'm real compulsive. And I said, no kidding. She said, I said, let me ask you a question. If you're trying to be spiritual and you're real compulsive and that's the Serenity Prayer, can I ask you, are you a friend of Bill Wilson's? And she stopped and sighed and she said, yeah. Are you? I said, no. I said, he died years before I got sober. I mean, you know, what am I going to do? Come to find out, this girl only had a couple years sober. This was her first trip away from her home group in sobriety. She went out to California on business for training for 2 weeks. She'd had a dream, a drunk dream, her first drunk dream the night before. She was, that was a premonition she was going to get drunk in California. She was petrified. We had a great two-hour, three-hour meeting going out there. You know, she cried a little bit, I cried a little bit. Gave her some friends I have in California to call and go to meetings. She said to me, she says, you know, I was trying to quit smoking, so I was sitting up in the non-smoking section. Can you believe that God would have me come back here to sit by you? Can you believe that when they said you guys can change seats because we're letting some standby people come on? Can you believe God had me move back here to sit by you? And I said, hell, he canceled my whole plane to get me to come over here to sit by you. You know? Come on, John. God ain't going to do that. You know, you cancel a plane so you can make a 12-step call. That's not what's going to happen. God's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in your life to help you, is he? Since God works through people, God ain't going to do that. You know? I'm down at a conference on the border of Texas and Mexico. Okay? And I'm down there at this little teeny conference, about 70 people, and during the Saturday afternoon, I met this gal, Dottie. Dottie E. on her badge, and she's from Connecticut. I said, Dottie, what are you doing in Del Rio, Texas, from Connecticut? She said, I'm on my way to see my husband. And we spent the night here last night. I was going to go on. He's in San Diego in the Navy. But we decided to spend the day in Del Rio. And I called the intergroup. They told me about this conference, so I came to the conference. I said, well, great. Welcome to Texas. So I spoke Saturday night. When I got through speaking, Dottie heard my story. She came up, talked to me, and she said, so you're from Utah? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, do you have any relatives in Orem, Utah? And I said, well, I grew up in Orem, Utah. And she said, well, are you related to Mark and Betty Joe? I said, well, they're my parents. And then Dottie starts to cry.
She says, I'm married to Bobby. See, he's my first cousin. That's what her E, you know, that said that E, last initial. And I said, you're kidding me. She said, no. She said, we got married in AA. Been married for 5 years. And I'm on my way to see him. He's in the Navy. So I hadn't seen Bobby since he's 3 days older than me. We grew up together, ripping and running. And we got out of high school. I went to college. He went to the Navy. And she said, I'm going to divorce him. Because he twisted off 2 years ago. And he ain't got sober since. He's drunk. And she said, I can't stand it anymore. So I'm going out there to divorce him. That opened up a little crack, and we made a 12-step con, Bobby. And now Bobby has 15 years, you know? Now, that's just a coincidence, isn't it? God, you know the odds of that? She's in Connecticut, he's in San Diego, I'm in Dallas, and we meet in Del Rio because she decided to spend the day. Nobody spends the day in Del Rio. They don't do that, you know? That I've made a gal married to my first cousin that I haven't seen for 18 years. That's just a coincidence. God ain't gonna. God ain't gonna put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information. Just God works through people. Right? Went over to speak in Hawaii at the state convention, and when I got over there that Friday morning, I got a phone call. My dad had died in Salt Lake. Had a heart attack and died. And we couldn't get off the island till Saturday afternoon. And they were going to bury him Monday morning, so we had to go a funny way. The only way we could do it, because all the planes were booked, we had to go from Hawaii to San Francisco. We had a 4.5-hour layover in San Francisco. Then we had to fly back down to Dallas, and then from Dallas over to Houston, then from Houston back to Salt Lake. And it took us 23.5 hours. I got in there Sunday afternoon. I was tired, and we buried my dad Monday morning. And Tuesday, I was leaving to go back to Dallas. And my son dropped me off at the airport. He had to go to work, and so I had about 2.5 hours by myself. And it was the first time I'd been by myself, and I was tired, I was exhausted, and I'm sitting there in the airport, and my mind started beating me up. You know, like, why weren't you at home with your dad? My dad had a heart attack 2 months prior to that. And I called my mom before we left, and she said, yeah, he's doing fine, go ahead and go. But you know what? The good son would have been home with his mom. I had no business being in Hawaii talking at that conference. I should have been with my mom when she needed me. You know, the good son would have done that. That's just ego bullshit. I should have been there. I should have really beat myself up about why was I over there to that conference when I should have been with my mom and my dad when he died. And I just started beating myself up. And a page came over the intercom system, and it said, would a friend of Bill W. pick up the white paging phone? I started laughing. I thought, he thinks he needs a 12-step call. You know. So I picked up the phone, and I met this guy in the coffee shop from Chicago. And I said, you page a lot of people for Bill W. when you're at the airport? He said, never done it before. Just want to see if there are any drunks in Utah. We had a great meeting. His dad had died a year prior to that. We had a great meeting there before I got on the airplane. You know, that just told me what I was supposed to be doing, what I was supposed to be doing. My dad was going to die anyway. I was there when I needed to be there. But my primary purpose is to help other alcoholics get to their sobriety. Keep my sobriety and help other alcoholics get theirs. You know? That's just coincidence, isn't it? I'm sure you all heard a lot of pages for Bill W. at the airport. You know? God ain't going to do that. He's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us when we need him. Now I share that story because I know there are some people here tonight, this morning, in this room, that are in a lot of pain. It doesn't seem to really matter whether you're 30 days sober or 30 years sober. Sobriety can be tough. And sometimes it hurts. And it's very painful because it makes no sense to you. Why is this going on? And sometimes you wonder, you know, it's like you've crawled over the edge of the precipice and you're looking into the abyss and you don't know, does God deal really work? Is God really in control? Is that just podium rhetoric we say to each other to make us feel better? Do I need to do something else? And if that's where you are, then you need to know that tonight, as this morning more than ever, I know that God loves us totally. I know that God is totally committed to our recovery and our happiness. And I know that God is willing to go to any lengths to see that we get it. I used to think that was a one-way street. I used to think that I had to be willing to go to any lengths to get sober. Today I know that God will go to any lengths to see that you get it. And if you need to borrow that kind of God till you can find a power of your own, then do it. Because I've borrowed your God's lots when I didn't know. When I was sitting there in the middle of it, and I thought, man, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this. What's going to happen? And thank God y'all have been there for me. And I don't know when God would help you. Sometimes it seems like it's forever. But I know what's going to happen. I know how he's going to help you. I know exactly how he's going to help you. What he's going to do is he's going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in your life to help you. Because God works through people. And I'm grateful that you'll let me share. Thank you very much.